hesitatingly. I don't want to say for certain. After all, these details aren't in my department. I'm just responsible for final assembly, not unit work. But this surely looks like the thing they installed. Big thing. Lots of power leads. It was a battleship, all right. No doubt of that now. I was mentally reaching around to pat myself on the back when the meaning of his words sank in. Installed? I shouted. Did you say installed? Rocca collapsed away from my roar and gnawed his nails. Yes, he said, not too long ago. I remember there was some trouble. And what else? I interrupted him. Cold moisture was beginning to collect along my spine now. The drives, controls, are they in too? Why, yes, he said. How did you know? The normal scheduling was changed around, causing a great deal of unnecessary trouble. The cold sweat was now a running river of fear. I was beginning to have the feeling that I had been missing the boat all along the line. The original estimated date of completion was nearly a year away. But there was no real reason why that couldn't be changed, too. Cars! Guns! I bellowed. To the space yard! If that ship is anywhere near completion, we are in big, big trouble. All the board guards had a great time with the sirens, lights, accelerators on the floor, and that sort of thing. We blasted a screaming hole through the night right to the space yard and through the gate. It didn't make any difference. We were still too late. A uniformed watchman frantically waved to us, and the whole convoy jerked to a stop. The ship was gone. Rocca couldn't believe it. Neither could the president. They wandered up and down the empty ways where it had been built. I just crunched down in the back of the car, chewing my cigar to pieces and cursing myself for being a fool. I had missed the obvious fact, being carried away by the thought of a planetary government building a warship. The government was involved, for sure, but only as a pawn. No little planet-bound political mind could have dreamed up as big a scheme as this. I smelled a rat. A stainless steel one. Someone who operated the way I had done before my conversion. Now that the rodent was well out of the bag, I knew just where to look, and had a pretty good idea of what I would find. Rocca, the space yard manager, had staggered back and was pulling at his hair, cursing and crying at the same time. President Ferraro had his gun out and was staring at it grimly. It was hard to tell if he was thinking of murder or suicide. I didn't care which. All he had to worry about was the next election, when the voters and the political competition would carve him up for losing the ship. My troubles were a little bigger. I had to find the battleship before it blasted its way across the galaxy. Rocca, I shouted, get into the car. I want to see your records, all of your records, and I want to see them right now. He climbed wearily in and had directed the driver before he fully realized what was happening. Blinking at the sickly light of dawn brought him slowly back to reality. But, Admiral, the hour! Everyone will be asleep. I just growled. But it was enough. Rocca caught the idea from my expression and grabbed the car phone. The office doors were open when we got there. Normally, I curse the paper tangles of bureaucracy, but this was one time when I blessed them all. These people had it down to a fine science. Not a rivet fell but that its fall was noted in quintuplicate, and later followed up with a memo, rivet, wastage, query. The facts I needed were all neatly tucked away in their paper catacombs. All I had to do was sniff them out. I didn't try to look for first causes. This would have taken too long. Instead, I concentrated my attention on the recent modifications, like the gun turret, that would quickly give me a trail to the guilty parties. Once the clerks understood what I had in mind, they hurled themselves into their work, urged on by the fires of patriotism and the burning voices of their superiors. All I had to do was suggest a line of search, and the relevant documents would begin appearing at once. Bit by bit, a pattern started to emerge. A delicate webwork of forgery, bribery, chicanery, and falsehood. It could only have been conceived by a mind as brilliantly crooked as my own. I chewed my lip with jealousy. Like all great ideas, this one was basically simple. A party, or parties unknown, had neatly warped the ship construction program to their own ends. Undoubtedly, they had started the program for the giant transport that would have to be checked later, and once the program was underway, it had been guided with a skill that bordered on genius. Orders were originated in many places, passed on, changed, and shuffled. I painfully traced each one to its source. Many times the source was a forgery. Some changes seemed to be unexplainable until I noticed the officers in question had a temporary secretary while their normal assistants were ill. All the girls had had food poisoning, a regular epidemic, it seemed. Each of them in turn had been replaced by the same girl. She stayed just long enough in each position to see that the battleship plan moved forward one more notch. This girl was obviously the assistant to the mastermind who originated the scheme. He sat in the center of the plot, like a spider on its web, pulling the strings that set things into motion. My first thought that a gang was involved proved wrong. All my secondary suspects turned out to be simple forgeries, not individuals. In the few cases where forgery wasn't adequate, my mysterious ex had apparently hired himself to do the job. X himself had the permanent job of assistant engineering designer. One by one, the untangled threads ran to this office. He also had a secretary whose illnesses coincided with her employment in other offices. When I straightened up from my desk, the ache in my back stabbed like a hot wire. I swallowed a painkiller and looked around at my drooping, sack-eyed assistants, who had shared the sleepless 72-hour task. They sat or slumped against the furniture, waiting for my conclusion. Even President Ferraro was there, his hair looking scraggly where he had pulled out handfuls. "You found them? The criminal ring?" he asked, his fingers groping over his scalp for a fresh hold. "I have found them, yes," I said hoarsely, "but not a criminal ring. An inspired master criminal who apparently has more executive ability in one earlobe than all your bribe-bloated bureaucrats. And his female assistant. They pulled the entire job by themselves. His name, or undoubtedly pseudo-name, is Pepe Nero. The girl is called Angelina. Arrest them at once! Guards! Guards!" Ferraro's voice died away as he ran out of the room. I talked to his vanishing back. "That is just what we intend to do, but it's a little difficult at the moment since they are the ones who not only built the battleship, but undoubtedly stole it as well. It was fully automated, so no crew is necessary."
"What do you plan to do?" one of the clerks asked.
"I shall do nothing," I told him, with the snapped precision of an old space veteran. "The League fleet is already closing in on the Renegades, and you will be informed of the capture. Thank you for your assistance." Chapter 6. I threw them as snappy a salute as I could muster, and they filed out. Staring gloomily at their backs, I envied for one moment their simple faith in the League Navy, when in reality the vengeful fleet was just as imaginary as my admiral's rating. This was still a job for the Corps. Inskip would have to be given the latest information at once. I had sent him a psiogram about the theft, but there was no answer as yet. Maybe the identity of the thieves would stir some response out of him. My message was in code, but it could be quickly broken if someone wanted to try hard enough. I took it to the message center myself. The Psi-Man was in his transparent cubicle, and I locked myself in with him. His eyes were unfocused as he spoke softly into a mic, pulling in a message from somewhere across the galaxy. Outside, the rushing transcribers copied, coded, and filed messages, but no sound penetrated the insulated wall. I waited until his attention clicked back into the room and handed him the sheets of paper. "League Central 14. Rush," I told him. He raised his eyebrows, but didn't ask any questions. Establishing contact only took a few seconds, as they had an entire battery of Psi-men for their communications. He read the code words carefully, shaping them with his mouth but not speaking aloud, the power of his thoughts carrying across the light years of distance. As soon as he was finished, I took back the sheet, tore it up, and pocketed the pieces. I had my answer back quickly enough. Inskip must have been hovering around waiting for my message. The mic was turned off to the transcribers outside, and I took the code groups down in shorthand myself. XYBB, DFIL, FDNO, and if you don't come back. The message broke into clear at the end, and the Psi-man smiled as he spoke the words. I broke the point off my stylus and growled at him not to repeat any of this message, as it was classified, and I would personally see him shot if he did. That got rid of the smile, but didn't make me feel any better. The decoded message turned out not to be as bad as I had imagined. Until further notice, I was in charge of tracking and capturing the stolen battleship. I could call on the League for any aid I needed. I would keep my identity as an admiral for the rest of the job. I was to keep him informed of progress. Only those ominous last words in clear kept my happiness from being complete. I had been handed my long-awaited assignment, but translated into simple terms, my orders were to get the battleship or it would be my neck. Never a word about my efforts in uncovering the plot in the first place. This is a heartless world we live in. This moment of self-pity relaxed me, and I immediately went to bed. Since my main job now was waiting, I could wait just as well as sleep. And waiting was all I could do. Of course, there were secondary tasks, such as ordering a naval cruiser for my own use and digging for more information on the thieves, but these really were secondary to my main purpose, which was waiting for bad news. There was no place I could go that would be better situated for the chase than Cheetah Nuovo. The missing ship could have gone in any direction. With each passing minute, the sphere of probable locations grew larger by the power of the squared cube. I kept the on-watch crew of the cruiser at duty stations and confined the rest within a 100-yard radius of the ship. There was little more information on Pepe and Angelina. They had covered their tracks well. Their backgrounds were unknown, though the fact they both talked with a slight accent suggested an off-world origin. There was one dim picture of Pepe, chubby but looking too grim to be a happy fat boy. There was no picture of the girl. I shuffled the meager findings, controlled my impatience, and kept the ship's Psi-man busy pulling in all the reports of any kind of trouble in space. The navigator and I plotted their locations in his tank, comparing the positions in relation to the growing sphere that enclosed all the possible locations of the stolen ship. Some of the disasters and apparent accidents hit inside this area, but further investigation proved them all to have natural causes. I had left standing orders that all reports falling inside the danger area were to be brought to me at any time. The messenger awoke me from a deep sleep, turning on the light and handed me the slip of paper. I blinked myself awake, read the first two lines, and pressed the action station alarm over my bunk. I'll say this, the Navy boys know their business. When the siren screamed, the crew secured ship and blasted off before I had finished reading the report. As soon as my eyeballs unsquashed back into focus, I read it through, then once more carefully from the beginning. It looked like the one we had been waiting for. There were no witnesses to the tragedy, but a number of monitor stations had picked up the discharge static of a large energy weapon being fired. Triangulation had led investigators to the spot where they found a freighter, Ogget's Dream, with a hole punched through it as big as a railroad tunnel. The freighter's cargo of plutonium was gone. I read Pepe in every line of the message. Since he was flying an undermanned battleship, he had used it in the most efficient way possible. If he attempted to negotiate or threaten another ship, the element of chance would be introduced. So he had simply roared up to the unsuspecting freighter and blasted her with the monster guns his battleship packed. All 18 men aboard had been killed instantly. The thieves were also murderers. I was under pressure now to act, and under a greater pressure not to make any mistakes. Roly-poly Pepe had shown himself to be a ruthless killer. He knew what he wanted, then reached out and took it, destroying anyone who stood in his way. More people would die before this was over. It was up to me to keep that number as small as possible. Ideally, I should have rushed out the fleet with guns blazing and dragged him to justice. Very nice, and I wished it could be done that way. Except where was he? A battleship may be gigantic on some terms of reference, but in the immensity of the galaxy it is microscopically infinitesimal. as long as it stayed out of the regular lanes of commerce and clear of detector stations and planets, it would never be found. Then how could I find it, and having found it, catch it? When the infernal thing was more than a match for any ship it might meet. That was my problem. It had kept me awake nights and talking to myself days, since there was no easy answer. I had to construct a solution, slowly and carefully. Since I couldn't be sure where Pepe was going to be next, I had to make him go where I wanted him to. There were some things in my favor. The most important was the fact I had forced him to make his play before he was absolutely ready. It wasn't chance that he had left the same day I arrived on Cheetah Nuvo. Any plan as elaborate as his certainly included warning of approaching danger. The drive on the battleship, as well as controls and primary armament, had been installed weeks before I showed up. Much of the subsidiary work remained to be done when the ship had left. One witness of the theft had graphically described the power lines and cables dangling from the ship's locks when she lifted. My arrival had forced Pepe off balance. Now I had to keep pushing until he fell. This meant I had to think as he did. Fall into his plan, think ahead, then trap him. Set a thief to catch a thief. A great theory, only I felt uncomfortably on the spot when I tried to put it into practice. A drink helped, as did a cigar. Puffing on it, staring at the smooth bulkhead, relaxed me a bit. After all, there aren't that many things you can do with a battleship. You can't run a big con, blow safes, or make Bermudex with it. It is hell on jets for space piracy, but that's about all. Great. Great. But why a battleship? I was talking to myself. Normally a bad sign, but right now I didn't care. The mood of space piracy had seized me, and I had been going along fine, until this glaring inconsistency jumped out and hit me square in the eye. Why a battleship? Why all the trouble and years of work to get a ship that two people could just barely manage? With a tenth of the effort, Pepe could have had a cruiser that would have suited his purposes just as well. Just as good for space piracy, that is, but not for his purposes. He had wanted a battleship, and he had gotten himself a battleship, which meant he had more in mind than simple piracy. What? It was obvious that Pepe was a monomaniac, an egomaniac, and as psychotic as a shorted computer. Someday the mystery of how he had slipped through the screen of official testing would have to be investigated. That wasn't my concern now. He still had to be caught. A plan was beginning to take shape in my head, but I didn't rush it. First, I had to be sure that I knew him well. Any man that can con an entire world into building a battleship for him, then steal it from them, is not going to stop there. The ship would need a crew, a base for refueling, and a mission. Fuel had been taken care of first. The gutted hull of Ogget's Dream was silent witness to that. There were countless planets that could be used as a base. Getting a crew would be more difficult in these peaceful times, although I could think of a few answers to that one, too. Raid the metal hospitals and jails. Do that often enough and you would have a crew that would make any pirate chief proud. Though piracy was, of course, too mean an ambition to ascribe to this boy. Did he want to rule a whole planet? Or maybe an entire system? Or more? I shuddered a bit as the thought hit me. Was there really anything that could stop a plan like this once it got rolling? During the Kingly Wars, any number of types with a couple of ships and less brains than Pepe had set up just this kind of empire. They were all pulled down in the end, since their success depended on one-man rule. But the price that had to be paid first. This was the plan, and I felt in my bones that I was right. I might be wrong on some of the minor details. They weren't important. I knew the general outline of the idea, just as when I bumped into a mark I knew how much he could be taken for and just how to do it. There are natural laws in crime, as in every other field of human endeavor. I knew this was it.
Get the communications officer in here at once, I shouted at the intercom. Also a couple of clerks with transcribers, and fast. This is a matter of life or death.
This last had a hollow ring, and I realized my enthusiasm had carried me out of character. I buttoned my collar, straightened my ribbons, and squared my shoulders. By the time they knocked on the door, I was all admiral again. Acting on my orders, the ship dropped out of warp drive, so our psi-man could get through to the other operators. Captain Steng grumbled as we floated there with the engine silent, wasting precious days, while half his crew was involved in getting out what appeared to be insane instructions. My plan was beyond his understanding, which is of course why he is a captain and I'm an admiral, even a temporary one. Following my orders, the navigator again constructed a sphere of speculation in his tank. The surface of the sphere contacted all the star systems a day's flight ahead of the maximum flight of the stolen battleship. There weren't too many of these at first, and the Psi-man could handle them all, calling each in turn and sending news releases to the naval public relations officers there. As the sphere kept growing, he started to drop behind, steadily losing ground. By this time, I had a general release prepared, along with directions for use and follow-up, which he sent to Central 14. The battery of Psi-men there contacted the individual planets, and all we had to do was keep adding to the list of planets. The release and follow-ups all harped on one theme. I expanded on it, waxed enthusiastic, condemned it, and worked it into an interview. I wrote as many variations as I could so it could be slipped into as many different formats as possible. In one form or another, I wanted the basic information in every magazine, newspaper, and journal inside that expanding sphere. "What in the devil does this nonsense mean?" Captain Steng asked peevishly. He had long since given up the entire operation as a futile one and spent most of the time in his cabin worrying about the effect of it on his service record. Boredom or curiosity had driven him out, and he was reading one of my releases with horror. "Billionaire to found own world space yacht filled with luxuries to last 100 years? The captain's face grew red as he flipped through the stack of notes. "What connection does this tripe have with catching those murderers?" When we were alone, he was anything but courteous to me, having assured himself by not too subtle questioning that I was a spurious admiral. There was no doubt I was still in charge, but our relationship was anything but formal. "This tripe nonsense," I told him, "is the bait that will snag our fish. A trap for Pepe and his partner in crime."
"Who is this mysterious billionaire?"
"Me," I said. "I've always wanted to be rich.
But this ship, the space yacht, where is it?"
"Being built now in the naval shipyard at Udrid. We're almost ready to go there now, soon as this batch of instructions goes out." Captain Steng dropped the releases onto the table, then carefully wiped his hands off to remove any possible infection. He was trying to be fair and considerate of my views and not succeeding in the slightest.
"It doesn't make sense," he growled. "How can you be sure this killer will ever read one of these things? And if he does, why should he be interested? It looks to me as if you are wasting time while he slips through your fingers. The alarm should be out and every ship notified, the Navy alerted and patrols set on all space lanes,
which he could easily avoid by going around, or better yet, not even bother about, since he can lick any ship we have." "That's not the answer," I told him. "This Pepe is smart and as tricky as a fixed gambling machine. That's his strength and his weakness as well. Characters like that never think it possible for someone else to outthink them, which is what I'm going to do."
"Modest, aren't you?" Steng said.
"I try not to be," I told him. "False modesty is the refuge of the incompetent. I'm going to catch this thug, and I'll tell you how I'll do it. He's going to hit again soon, and wherever he hits, there will be some kind of a periodical with my plant in it. Whatever else he is after, he is going to take all of the magazines and papers he can find. Partly to satisfy his own ego, but mostly to keep track of the things he is interested in. Such as ship sailings."
"You're just guessing. You don't know all this."
His automatic assumption of my incompetence was beginning to get me annoyed. I bridled my temper and tried one last time. Yes, I'm guessing. An informed guess, but I do know some facts as well. Ogget's dream was cleaned out of all reading matter. That was one of the first things I checked. We can't stop the battleship from attacking again, but we can see to it that the time after that she sails into a trap.
I don't know, the captain said. It sounds to me like...
I never heard what it sounded like, which is all right, since he was getting under my skin, and I might have been tempted to pull my pseudo-rank. The alarm sirens cut his sentence off, and we foot-raced to the communications room. Captain Steng won by a nose. It was his ship, and he knew all the shortcuts. The Psi-man was holding out a transcription, but he summed it up in one sentence. He looked at me while he talked, and his face was hard and cold.
They hit again. Knocked out a Navy supply satellite. 34 men dead.
If your plan doesn't work, Admiral, the captain whispered hoarsely in my ear, I'll personally see that you're flayed alive. If my plan doesn't work, Captain, there won't be enough of my skin left to pick up with a tweezer. Now, if you please, I'd like to get to Udrid and board my ship as soon as possible. The easygoing hatred and contempt of all my associates had annoyed me, thrown me off balance. I was thinking with anger now, not with logic. Forcing a bit of control, I ordered my thoughts, checking off a mental list.
Belay that last command, I shouted, getting back into my old space dog mood. Get a call through first and find out if any of our plants were picked up during the raid.
While the Psi-man unfocused his eyes and mumbled under his breath, I riffled some papers, relaxed and cool. The ratings and officers waited tensely and made some slight attempt to conceal their hatred of me. It took about 10 minutes to get an answer.
Affirmative, the Psi-man said. A store ship docked there 20 hours before the attack. Among other things, it left newspapers containing the article.
Very good, I said calmly. Send a general order to suspend all future activity with the planted releases.
Send it by Psi-men only.
No mention on any other naval signaling equipment. There's a good chance now it might be overheard. I strolled out slowly, in command of the situation, keeping my face turned away so they couldn't see the cold sweat. It was a fast run to Udrid, where my billionaire's yacht, the Eldorado, was waiting. The dockyard commander showed me the ship and made a noble effort to control his curiosity. I took a sadistic revenge on the Navy by not telling him a word about my mission. After checking out the controls and special apparatus with the technicians, I cleared the ship. There was a tape in the automatic navigator that would put me on the course mentioned in all the articles, just a press of a button and I would be on my way. I pressed the button. It was a beautiful ship, and the dockyard had been lavish with their attention to detail. From bow to rear tubes, she was plated in pure gold. There are other metals with a higher albedo, but none that give a richer effect. All the fittings, inside and out, were either machine-turned or plated. All this work could not have been done in the time allotted. The Navy must have adapted a luxury yacht to my needs. Everything was ready. Either Pepe would make his move, or I would sail on to my billionaire's paradise planet. If that happened, it would be best if I stayed there. Now that I was in space, past the point of no return, all the doubts that I had dismissed fought for attention. The plan that had seemed so clear and logical now began to look like a patched and crazy makeshift.
"Hold on there, sailor," I said to myself, using my best admiral's voice. "Nothing has changed. It's still the best and only plan possible under the circumstances."
Was it? Could I be sure that Pepe, flying his mountain of a ship and eating Navy rations, would be interested in some of the comforts and luxuries of life? Or if the luxuries didn't catch his eye, would he be interested in the planetary homesteading gear? I had loaded the cards with all the things he might want, and planted the information where he could get it. He had the bait now, but would he grab the hook? I couldn't tell. And I could work myself into a neurotic state if I kept running through the worry cycle. It took an effort to concentrate on anything else, but it had to be made. The next 4 days passed very slowly.
Chapter 7. When the alarm blew off, all I felt was an intense sensation of relief. I might be dead and blasted to dust in the next few minutes, but that didn't seem to make much difference. Pepe had swallowed the bait. There was only one ship in the galaxy that could knock back a blip that big at such a distance. It was closing fast, using the raw energy of the battleship engines for a headlong approach. My ship bucked a bit as the tug beams locked on at maximum distance. The radio bleeped at me for attention at the same time. I waited as long as I dared, then flipped it on. The voice boomed out.
"That you are under the guns of a warship! Don't attempt to run, signal, take evasive action, or in any other way!
Who are you, and what the devil do you want?" I spluttered into the mic. I had my scanner on so they could see me, but my own screen stayed dark. They weren't sending any picture. In a way, it made my act easier. I just played to an unseen audience. They could see the rich cut of my clothes, the luxurious cabin behind me. Of course, they couldn't see my hands.
"It doesn't matter who we are," the radio boomed again. "Just obey orders if you care to live. Stay away from the controls until we have tied on. Then do exactly as I say."
There were two distant clangs as magnetic grapples hit the hull. A little later, the ship lurched, drawn home against the battleship. I let my eyes roll in fear, looking around for a way to escape, and taking a peek at the outside scanners. The yacht was flush against the space-filling bulk of the other ship. I pressed the button that sent the torch-wielding robot on his way. "Now let me tell you something," I snapped into the mic, wiping away the worried billionaire expression. "First, I'll repeat your own warning. Obey orders if you want to live. I'll show you why." When I threw the big switch, a carefully worked out sequence took place. First, of course, the hull was magnetized and the bombs fused. A light blinked as the scanner in the cabin turned off and the one in the generator room came on. I checked the monitor screen to make sure, then started into the spacesuit. It had to be done fast. At the same time, it was necessary to talk naturally. They must still think of me as sitting in the control room. "That's the ship's generators you're looking at," I said. 98% of their output is now feeding into coils that make an electromagnet of this ship's hull. You will find it very hard to separate us. And I would advise you not to try." The suit was on, and I kept the running chatter up through the mic in the helmet, replaying to the ship's transmitter. The scene in the monitor receiver changed. "You are now looking at a hydrogen bomb that is primed and aware of the magnetic field holding our ships together. It will, of course, go off if you try to pull away." I grabbed up the monitor receiver and ran toward the airlock. "This is a different bomb now," I said, keeping one eye on the screen and the other on the slowly opening outer door. "This one has receptors on the hull. If you attempt to destroy any part of this ship or even gain entry to it, this one will detonate." I was in space now, leaping across to the gigantic wall of the other ship.
"What do you want?"
These were the first words Pepe had spoken since his first threats.
"I want to talk to you. Arrange a deal. Something that would be profitable for both of us. But let me first show you the rest of the bombs, so you won't get any strange ideas about cooperating."
Of course I had to show him the rest of the bombs. There was no getting out of it. The scanners in the ship were following a planned program. I made light talk about all my massive armament that would carry us both to perdition, while I climbed through the hole in the battleship's hull. There was no armor or warning devices at this spot. It had been chosen carefully from the blueprints.
"Yeah, yeah. I take your word for it. You're a flying bomb. So stop with this roving reporter bit and tell me what you have in mind."
This time I didn't answer him, because I was running and panting like a dog and had the mic turned off. Just ahead, if the blueprints were right, was the door to the control room. Pepe should be there. I stepped through, gun out, and pointed it at the back of his head. Angelina stood next to him, looking at the screen.
"The game's over," I said. "Stand up slowly and keep your hands in sight."
"What do you mean?"
he said angrily, looking at the screen in front of him. The girl caught wise first. She spun around and pointed. "He's here!" They both stared, gaped at me, caught off guard and completely unprepared. "You're under arrest, Crime King," I told him. "And your girlfriend." Angelina rolled her eyes up and slid slowly to the floor. Real or faked, I didn't care. I kept the gun on Pepe's pudgy form while he picked her up and carried her to an acceleration couch against the wall.
What will happen now?
He quavered the question. His pouchy jaws shook, and I swear there were tears in his eyes. I was not impressed by his acting, since I could clearly remember the dead men floating in space. He stumbled over to a chair, half dropping into it. "Will they do anything to me?" Angelina asked. Her eyes were open now. "I have no idea of what will happen to you," I told her truthfully. "That is up to the courts to decide." "But he made me do all those things," she wailed. She was young, dark, and beautiful. The tears did nothing to spoil this. Pepe dropped his face into his hands, and his shoulders shook. I flicked the gun his way and snapped at him. "Sit up, Pepe. I find it very hard to believe that you are crying. There are some naval ships on the way now. The automatic alarm was triggered about a minute ago. I'm sure they'll be glad to see the man who..." "Don't let them take me, please." Angelina was on her feet now, her back pressed to the wall. "They'll put me in prison, do things to my mind." She shrank away as she spoke, stumbling along the wall. I looked back at Pepe, not wanting to have my eyes off him for an instant. "There's nothing I can do," I told her. I glanced her way, and a small door was swinging open, and she was gone. "Don't try to run," I shouted after her. "It can't do any good." Pepe made a strangling noise, and I looked back to him quickly. He was sitting up now, and his face was dry of tears. In fact, he was laughing, not crying.
"So she caught you too, Mr. Wise Cop. Poor little Angelina with the soft eyes."
He broke down again, shaking with laughter. "What do you mean?" I growled.
"Don't you catch yet? The story she told you was true, except she twisted it around a bit. The whole plan, building the battleship, then stealing it, was hers. She pulled me into it, played me like an accordion. I fell in love with her, hating myself and happy at the same time. Well, I'm glad now it's over. At least I gave her a chance to get away, I owe her that much. Though I thought I would explode when she went into that innocence act."
The cold feeling was now a ball of ice that threatened to paralyze me.
"You're lying," I said hoarsely, and even I didn't believe it. "Sorry, that's the way it is. Your brain boys will pick my skull to pieces and find out the truth anyway. There's no point in lying now."
"We'll search the ship. She can't hide for long."
"She won't have to," Pepe said. "There's a fast scout we picked up stowed in one of the holds. That must be it leaving now."
We could feel the vibration distantly through the floor.
"The Navy will get her," I told him, with far more conviction than I felt. "Maybe," he said, suddenly slumped and tired, no longer laughing. "Maybe they will. But I gave her her chance. It is all over for me now, but she knows that I loved her to the end."
He bared his teeth in sudden pain.
"Not that she will care in the slightest."
I kept the gun on him, and neither of us moved while the Navy ships pulled up and their boots stamped outside. I had captured my battleship, and the raids were over. And I couldn't be blamed if the girl had slipped away. If she evaded the Navy ships, that was their fault, not mine. I had my victory, all right. But I wasn't too happy about it. I had a premonition that I wasn't finished with Angelina yet. Chapter 8. Life would have been much sweeter if my uneasy hunch hadn't proven to be true. You can't blame the Navy for being taken in by Angelina. They were neither the first nor the last to underestimate the mind that lay behind those melting eyes. And I try not to blame myself either. After my first mistake in letting Angelina slip out, I tried not to make a second. I wasn't completely convinced yet that Pepe was telling the truth about her. The entire story might be a complicated lie to confuse and throw me off guard. I have a very suspicious mind. Playing it safe, I kept the muzzle of my gun aimed exactly between his eyes, with my fingers resting lightly on the trigger. I kept it there until a squad of space marines thundered in and took over. As soon as they put the grab on Pepe, I sent out an all-ships alarm about Angelina, with a special take-all precautions priority. Even before all the ships had acknowledged receipt, her scout rocket was sighted on the detector screen. I sighed with a great deal of relief. If she did turn out to be the brains of the operation, I didn't want her slipping away. She, Pepe, and the battleship made a nice package to turn over to Inskip. There was no chance of her escaping now, with ships closing in on her from every direction. They were experienced at this sort of thing, and it was only a matter of time before they had her. Turning over the battleship to the Navy, I went back to the luxury yacht and tapped the stores for a large glass of Scotch whiskey that had never been within 20 light-years of Earth, and a long cigar. Sitting comfortably in front of the screen, I monitored the chase. Angelina wriggled painfully on the hook, making high G turns to avoid capture. She'd be black and blue from head to foot after some of those 15G accelerations. It was all for nothing because in the end they still caught her in a tractor web and closed in. All the thrashing around had just gained her a little time. None of us realized how important this time really was, until the boarding party cracked into the ship. It was empty, of course. Fully 10 days went by before we pieced together what had really happened. It was ruthless and ugly, and even if the psych docs hadn't assured me that Pepe had told the truth, I would have recognized the manner in which the escape was carried out. Angelina was one step ahead of us all the way. When she had escaped from the battleship and the scout rocket, she had made no attempt to flee. Instead, she must have gone at full blast to the nearest Navy ship, a 12-man pocket cruiser. They, of course, had no idea what had really happened aboard the battleship, as I hadn't put out the general alarm yet. I should have done that as soon as she had escaped. If I had, 12 good men might still be alive. We'll never know what story she told them, but it was obvious they weren't on their guard. Probably something about being a prisoner and escaping during the fighting. In any case, she took the ship. 5 of the men were dead of gas poisoning, the others shot. We discovered this when the cruiser was later found drifting and inert, parsecs away. After capturing the cruiser, she had set the controls on the scout ship for evasion tactics and launched it. While we were all merrily chasing it, she simply let her ship drop behind the chase and vanished from the fleet. Her trail blurs there. It is obvious she must have captured another ship. What this ship was and where she went in it was a complete mystery. Back in Corps headquarters, I found myself trying to explain this all to Inskip. He had a cold eye and hardened manner, and I found myself trying to justify my actions. "You can't win them all," I said. "I brought home your battleship and Pepe. May his personality rest in peace now that it has been erased. Angelina tricked me and got away, I'll admit that. But she did a much better job of fooling the boys in the Navy." "Why so much venom?" Inskip asked in an arid voice. "No one's accusing you of dereliction of duty. You sound like a man with a guilty conscience. You did a good job, a fine job, a great job for a first assignment." "You're doing it again," I howled, prodding my conscience to see how soft it is. "By keeping him around." I pointed to Pepe Nero, who was sitting near us in the restaurant, eating slowly, mumbling to himself with vacant-eyed dullness. His old personality had been stripped from his mind and a new one implanted. Only the body remained of the old Pepe, who had loved Angelina and stolen a battleship. "The psychs are working on a new theory of body personality," Inskip said blandly. "So why not keep him around here under observation? If any of his criminal tendencies should develop in the new personality, we'll be in a wonderful spot to recruit him for the Corps." "Does he bother you?" Not him, I snorted. After the massacres he pulled for his psychotic girlfriend, you could grind him into hamburger for all I care. But he does remind me that she is still out there somewhere, free and planning new mischief. I want to go after her.
Well, you're not, Inskip said. You've asked me before, and I have refused before. The topic is now closed.
But I could...
You could what?
He gave me a nasty chuckle.
Every law officer in the galaxy has a pick of her, and there is a continual search going on. How could you possibly do more than they are already doing?
I couldn't, I guess, I grumbled. So the hell with it, as you say. I pushed my plate away and stood and stretched as naturally as I could. I'm going to get a large jug of liquid refreshment and go to my quarters and nurse my sorrows.
You do that, and forget Angelina. Come to my office at 0900 hours tomorrow, and you better be sober.
Slave driver, I moaned, going out the door and turning down the hall towards the residence wing. As soon as I was out of sight, I took a side ramp that led to the spaceport. That's one lesson I had already learned from Angelina. When you have a plan, put it into action instantly. Don't let it lie around and get stale and have other people start thinking about it themselves. I was putting myself up against the shrewdest man in the business now, and the thought alone was enough to make me sweat. I was going against Inskip's direct orders, walking out on him and the Corps. Not really walking out, since I only wanted to finish the job I had started for them, but I was obviously the only one who would look at it that way. There were tools, gadgets, and a good deal of money in my quarters that would come in very handy on this job. I would just have to do without them. When Inskip started to think about my sudden conversion to his point of view, I wanted to be well away in space. A mechanic with a drag robot was pulling an agent's ship into place on the launching ramp. I stamped over and used my official voice.
Is that my ship?
No, sir. It's for Full Agent Nielsen. There he is, coming up now. Check with Central Control, will you? It's going to be a rush no matter how we handle it.
No job, Jimmy?
Ove asked as he came up. I nodded and watched the mechanic until he vanished around the corner.
Same old business, I said. And how's your tennis game coming, I asked, lifting my hand with an imaginary racket.
Getting better all the time, he said, turning his head to look at his ship. I'll teach you a new stroke, I said, bringing my hand down sharply and catching him on the side of the neck with the straightened edge. He folded without a sound, and I lowered him gently to the deck and dragged him out of sight behind a row of lubrication drums. I gently pried the box with the course tapes from his limp fingers. Before the mechanic could return, I was in the ship and had the lock sealed. I fed the course tape into the controls and punched the tower combination for clearance. There was a subjective century of waiting, during which eternal period of time I produced a fine beading of sweat all over my head. Then the green light came on. Step one, and still in the clear. As soon as the launching acceleration stopped, I was out of the chair and attacking the control panel with the screwdriver ready in my hand. There was always a remote control unit here, so that any core ship could be flown from a distance. I had discovered it on my first flight in one of these ships, since I have always maintained that there is a positive value to being nosy. I disconnected the input and output leads, then dived for the engine room. Perhaps I am too suspicious or have too low an opinion of mankind, or of Inskip, who had his own rules on most subjects. Someone more trusting than I would have ignored the radio-controlled suicide bomb built into the engine. This could be used to scuttle the ship in case of capture. I didn't think they would use it on me except as a last resort. Nevertheless, I still wanted it disconnected. The bomb was an integral part of the engine mounting, a solid block of Bermudex built into the casing. The lid dropped off easily enough, and inside there was a maze of circuits, all leading to a fuse screwed into the thick metal. It had a big hex head on it, and I scraped my knuckles trying to get a wrench around it and turn it in the close quarters. With the last grate of bruised flesh and knuckle bones, I twisted it free. It hung down from its wire leads, a nerve drawn from a deadly tooth. Then it exploded with a loud bang and a cloud of black smoke. With most unnatural calm, I looked from the cloud of dispersing smoke back to the black hole in the Bermudex charge. This would have turned the ship and its contents into a fine dust. "Inskip," I said, but my throat was dry and my voice cracked and I had to start again. "Inskip, I get your message. You thought you were giving me my discharge. Accept instead my resignation from the Special Corps." Chapter 9. My most overwhelming feeling was one of relief. I was on my own again and responsible to no man. I actually hummed a bit as I dropped the ship out of warp drive long enough to slip in a course tape chosen at random from the file. There would be no chance of an intercept this way, and I could cut a tape for a new course once I was well clear of the headquarters station. A course to where? I wasn't sure yet. That would require a bit of research, though there was no doubt about what I would be doing. Looking for Angelina. At first thought it seemed a little stupid to be taking on a job the Corps had refused me. It was still their job. On second thought I realized that it had nothing to do with the Corps now. Angie had pulled a fast one on me, pinned on the prize chump medal. That is something that you just don't do to slippery Jim DeGriz. Call it ego if you like, but ego is the only thing that keeps a man in my profession operating. Remove that, and you have removed everything. I had no real idea of what I would do with her when I found her. Probably turn her over to the police, since people like her gave the business a bad name. Better to worry about cooking the fish after I had caught it. A plan was necessary, so I prepared all the plan-producing ingredients. For one terrible moment, I thought there were no cigars in the ship. Then the service unit groaned and produced a box from some dark corner of the deep freeze. Not the recommended way to store cigars, but much better than having none at all. Nielsen always favored a rare brand of potent aquavit, and I had no objections to drinking it. Feet up, throat lubricated, and cigar smoking, I put the think box to work on the project. To begin with, I had to put myself in Angelina's place at the time of her escape. I would like to have gone back physically to the scene, but I'm not that thick. There was guaranteed to be a trigger-happy Navy ship or two sitting there. However, this is the kind of problem they build computers to solve, so I fed in the coordinates of the space action where it had all happened. There was no need for notes on this. Those figures were scratched inside my forehead in letters of fire. The computer had a large memory store and a high-speed scan. It hummed happily when I asked for the stars nearest to the given position. In under 13 seconds it flipped through its catalogs, counted on its fingers, and rang its little computation-finished bell for me. I copied off the numbers of the first dozen stars, then pressed the cancel when I saw the distances were getting too great to be relevant anymore. Now I must think like Angelina. I had to be hunted, hurried. A murderess with 12 fresh corpses of my own manufacture piled around me. In every direction rode the enemy. She would have the same list ground out by the computer on the stolen cruiser. Now, where to? Tension and speed. Get going somewhere, somewhere away from here. A glance at the list and the answer seemed obvious. The two nearest stars were in the same quadrant of the sky, within 15 degrees of each other. They were roughly equidistant. What was more important was the fact that star number 3 was in a different sector of the sky and twice as far away. That was the way to go toward the first two stars. It was the sort of decision that can be made in a hurry and still be sound. Head toward suns and worlds and the lanes where other ships could be found. The cruiser would have to be gotten rid of before any planets were approached, the faster the better since every ship in the galaxy would be looking for it. Then meet another ship, Ship X, and capture it. Abandon the cruiser and do what? My tenuous line of logic was ready to snap at this point, so I strengthened it with some aquavit and a fresh cigar. With my eyes half closed in reverie, I tried to rebuild the flight. Capture the new ship and head for a planet. As long as she was alone in space, Angelina was in constant danger. A planetfall and a change of personality were called for. When I looked up those two target stars in the catalog, the planetary choice was obvious. A barbaric-sounding place named Freiburg. There were a half-dozen other settled planets around the two suns, but all eliminated themselves easily. Either too lightly settled so that a stranger would be easily spotted, or organized and integrated so well that it would be impossible to be around long without some notice being taken. Freiburg shared none of these difficulties. It had been in the League for less than 200 years and would be in a happily chaotic state. A mixture of the old and new, pre-contact culture and post-contact civilization. The perfect place for her to slip into quietly and lose herself until she could appear with a fresh identity. Reaching this conclusion produced a double glow of satisfaction. This was more than a mental exercise in survival, since I was now roughly in the same place Angelina had been. The incident with the scuttling charge was a strong indication of the value the Corps put on their ships, and the low value they placed on deserters. Freiburg was a place that would suit me perfectly. I retired happily with a slight buzz on and a scorched mouth from the dehydrated cigars. When I dragged myself back to consciousness, it was time to drop out of warp space and plot a new course. Except there was one thing I had to do first. A lot of the little facts I knew had not been picked up in the core. One fact, normally of interest only to warp drive technicians, concerns the curious propagation of radiation in warp space. Radio waves in particular. They just don't go anyplace. If you broadcast on one frequency, you get a strong return signal on all frequencies, as if the radio waves had been squeezed out thin and bounced right back. Normally of no interest, this exotic phenomena is just the thing to find out if your ship is bugged. I put nothing beyond the special core, and bugging their own ships seemed a logical precaution. A concealed radio transmitting on a narrow band would lead them right to me wherever I went. This I had to find out before getting near any planets. There was a squeal and a growl from the speaker, and I cursed my former employers. But before I wasted my time looking for a transmitter, I ought to be sure one was there. Whatever was producing the signal seemed too weak to be picked up at any distance. Some quick work with a few sheets of shielding showed that my mysterious signal was nothing more than leaking radiation from the receiver itself. After it was shielded, the ether was quiet. I enjoyed a sigh of justified satisfaction and dropped out of warp. Once I had a course plotted, the trip wasn't a long one. I took the opportunity to scrounge through the ship's equipment and put together a kit for future use. The elaborate makeup and appearance alteration machinery begged to be used, and of course I did. Rebuilding the working personality of Slippery Jim was a positive pleasure. As the nose plugs and cheek pads skipped into place and the dye seeped into my hair, I sighed and relaxed with happiness. An old war horse getting back on the job. Then I scowled, growled at myself in the mirror, and began to remove the disguise as carefully as I had assumed it. It has always been axiomatic with me that there is no relaxation in this line of business, and anything done by rote usually leads to disaster. Inskip knew my old working personality only too well, and they would surely be looking for me under that description as well as my normal one. The second time around, I took a little more care with the disguise, and built up an entirely different appearance. A simple one, with facial and hair changes that would be easily maintained. The more elaborate a job of makeup is, the more time it takes to keep it accurate. Freiburg was a big question mark so far, and I didn't want to be loaded with any extra responsibilities like this. I wanted to go in relaxed, sniff around, and see if I could pick up Angelina's trail. There were still two subjective days left in warp drive, and I put these to good use, making some simple gadgetry that might come in handy. Pinhead grenades, tie-clasp pistols, ring drills, the usual thing. I only brushed away the scraps and cleaned the shop up when the ship signaled the end of the trip. The only city on Freiburg with a ground-controlled spaceport was at Freiburg Bad, which was situated on the shore of an immense lake, the only sizable body of fresh water on the planet. Looking at the sunlight glinting from it, I had the sudden desire for a swim. This urge must have been the genesis of my idea to drown the stolen ship. Leave it at the bottom of a deep spot in the lake, and it would always be handy if needed. I made planetfall over a jagged mountain range, and picked up not as much as a beep on the radar. Coming in over the lake after dark, I detected navigation radar from the spaceport, but my ship wouldn't get too far inshore. A rainstorm, cut through with hail, shortened visibility and removed my earlier bathing desire. There was a deep underwater channel not too far from shore, and I touched down above it while I put my kit together. It would be foolish to carry too much, but some of the core gear was too valuable to leave behind. Sealing it in a waterproof cover, I strapped it to my spacesuit and opened the airlock. Rain and darkness washed over me as I struck out for the unseen shore. I imagined, rather than heard, the gurgle behind me as the ship sank gently to the bottom. Swimming in a spacesuit is about as easy to manage as making love in free fall. I churned my way to shore in a state of near exhaustion. After crawling out of the suit, I had a great deal of pleasure watching it burn to a cinder under the heat of 3 thermite bombs. I particularly enjoyed kicking the resultant hissing slag into the lake. The rain hammered down and washed all traces of the burning away. Apparently even the fierce light of the thermite had gone unobserved in the downpour. Huddling under a waterproof sheet, I waited damply and miserably for dawn. Sometime during the night I dozed off without meaning to, because it was already light when I woke up. Something was very wrong, and before I could remember what had woken me, the voice called again.
"Going to Freiburg, Bon? Of course, where else is there to go? I'm going there myself. Got a boat. Old boat, but a good boat. Beats walking."
The voice went on and on, but I wasn't listening. I was cursing myself for being caught unaware by this joker with the long-playing voice. He was riding in a small boat just offshore. The thing was low in the water with bales and bundles, and the man's head stuck above the top of everything. While his jaw kept moving, I had a chance to look at him and draw my sleep-sodden wits together. He had a wild and bristly beard that stuck out in all directions and tiny dark eyes hidden under the most decrepit hat I had ever seen. Some of my startled panic ebbed away. If this oddball wasn't a plant, the accidental meeting might be turned to my benefit. When Mattress Face stopped to drag in a long overdue breath, I accepted his offer and reached for the gunwale of the boat and drew it closer. I picked up my bundle, getting my hand on my gun butt as I did it, and jumped in. There didn't seem to be any need for caution. Zug, that was his name, I plucked it out of the flowing stream of his monologue, bent over an outboard motor clamped to the stern and coaxed it to life. It was a tired-looking atomic heat exchanger, simple but efficient. No moving parts, it simply sucked in cold lake water, heated it to a boil, and shot it out through an underwater jet. Made almost no sound while running, which was how the rig had slid up without wakening me. Everything about Zug seemed normal. I still wasn't completely convinced, and kept the gun close to my hand. But if it was normal, I had hit a piece of luck. His cataract of words washed over me, and I began to understand why. Apparently, he was a hunter, bringing his pelts to market after months of solitude and silence. The sight of a human face had induced a sort of verbal diarrhea, which I made no attempt to stop. He was answering a lot of questions for me. One thing that had been a worry were my clothes. I had finally decided to wear a one-piece ship suit done in neutral gray. You see this kind of outfit, with minor variations, on planets right across the galaxy. It had passed unnoticed by Zug, which wasn't really saying much, since he was anything but a clothes fancier. He must have made his jacket himself out of the local fur. It was purplish-black and must have been very fine before the grease and twigs had been rubbed in. His pants were made of machine-woven cloth, and his boots were the same as mine, of Eternine plastic. If he was allowed to walk around loose in this outfit, mine would surely never be noticed. What I could see of Zug's equipment bore out the impression gained from his clothes, the old and new mixed together. A world like Freiber, not too long in the League, would be expected to be like that. The electrostatic rifle leaning against a bundle of steel bolts for the crossbow made a typical picture. Undoubtedly, the voice of the wilderness here could use both weapons with equal facility. I settled down on the soft bundles and enjoyed the voyage and the visual pleasures of the misty dawn, bathed continually in a flow of words. We reached Freiberbad before noon. Zug had more of an ambition to talk than to be talked to, and a few vague remarks of mine about going to the city satisfied him. He greatly enjoyed the food concentrates from my pack, and reciprocated by producing a flask of some noxious home brew he had distilled in his mountain retreat. The taste was indescribably awful, and left the mouth feeling as if it had been rasped by steel wool soaked in sulfuric acid. But the first few drinks numbed, and after that we enjoyed the trip, until we tied up at a fish-smelling dock outside the city. We almost swamped the boat getting out of it, which we thought hysterically funny, and which will give you some indication of our mental state at the time. I walked into the city proper and sat in a park until my head cleared. The old and the new pressed shoulders here, plastic-fronted buildings wedged in between brick and plaster. Steel, glass, wood, and stone, all mixed with complete indifference. The people were the same, dressed in a strange mixture of types and styles. I took more notice of them than they did of me. A news robot was the only thing that singled me out for attention. It blatted its dull offerings in my ear and waved a board with the printed headlines until I bought a paper to get rid of it. League currency was in circulation here, as well as local money, and the robot made no protest when I slipped a credit in its chest slot, though it did give me change in Freiberg Gilden, undoubtedly at a ruinous rate of exchange. At least that's the way I would have done it if I were programming the thing. All of the news was unimportant and trivial. The advertisements were of much more interest. Looking through the big hotels, I compared their offered pleasures and prices. It was this that set me to trembling and sweating with terror. How quickly we lose the ingrained habits of a lifetime. After a month on the side of law and order, I was acting like an honest man. "You're a criminal," I muttered through clenched teeth and spat on a no-spitting sign. "You hate the law and live happily without it. You are a law unto yourself and the most honest man in the galaxy. You can't break any rules since you make them up yourself and change them whenever you see fit." All of this was true, and I hated myself for forgetting it. That little period of honesty in the core was working like a blight to destroy all of my best antisocial tendencies. "Think dirty," I cried aloud, startling a girl who was walking by on the path. I leered to prove that she had heard correctly, and she hurried quickly away. That was better. I left myself at the same time, in the opposite direction, looking for an opportunity to do bad. I had to reestablish my identity before I could even consider finding Angelina. Opportunity was easy to find. Within 10 minutes I had spotted my target. I had all the equipment I might need in my sack. What I would use for the job I stowed in my pockets and waste wallet, then checked my bag in a public locker. Everything about the First Bank of Freiber begged to be cracked. It had 3 entrances, 4 guards, and was busily crowded. 4 human guards. No bank in existence would pay all those salaries if they had electronic protection. It was an effort not to hum with happiness as I stood in line for one of the human clerks. Fully automated banks aren't hard to rob, they just require different techniques. This mixture of man and machine was the easiest of all. "Change a League 10-star for Gilden," I said, slapping the shiny coin on the counter before him. "Yes, sir," the cashier said, only glancing at the coin and feeding it into the accounting machine next to him. His fingers had already set up the amount for me in Gilden, even before the currency valid signal blinked on. My money rattled down into the cup before me, and I counted it slowly. This was done mechanically, because my mind was really on the 10-credit coin now rolling and clinking down inside the machine's innards. When I was sure it had finished its trip and landed in the vault, I pressed the button on my wrist transmitter. It was beautiful, That was the only word for it. The kind of thing that leaves a warm glow lodged in the memory, that produces a twinge of happiness for years after whenever it is nudged. That little 10-credit coin had taken hours to construct, and every minute was worth it. I had sliced it in half, hollowed it out, loaded it with lead back to its original weight, built in a tiny radio receiver, a fuse, and a charge of Bermadex, which now went off with an incredibly satisfactory explosion. A grinding thump deep in the bank's entrails was followed by a tremendous amount of clanking and banging. The rear wall, containing the vault, split open and disgorged a torrent of money and smoke. Some last effort of the expiring accounting machine gave me an unexpected dividend. The money dispensers at every cashier station burst into frantic life. A torrent of large and small coins poured out on the startled customers, who quickly mastered their surprise and began grabbing. Their moment of pleasure was brief, because the same radio cue had set off the smoke and gas bombs I had thoughtfully dropped in all the waste baskets. Unnoticed in the excitement, I threw a few more gas bombs in with the cashiers. This gas is an effective mixture of my own concoction, a sinister brew of regurgitants and lacrimatories. Its effect was instantaneous and powerful. There were, of course, no children in the bank, since I don't believe in being cruel to those too young to protect themselves. Within seconds, the clients and employees found themselves unable to see, and too preoccupied to take any notice of me. As the gas rolled towards me, I lowered my head and slipped the goggles over my eyes. When I looked up, I was the only person in the bank that was able to see. I was, of course, careful to breathe through the filter plugs in my nose so I could enjoy the continued digestion of my last meal. My teller had vanished from sight, and I did a neat dive through the opening, sliding across the counter on my stomach. After this, it was just a matter of pick and choose. There was certainly no shortage of money rolling around loose. I ignored the small stuff and went to the source, the riven vault out of which poured a golden torrent. Within 2 minutes, I had filled the bag I had brought and was ready to leave. The smoke near the doors was thinning a bit, but a few more grenades took care of that. Everything was working perfectly and under control, except for one fool of a guard who was making a nuisance of himself. His tiny brain realized dimly that something wrong was going on, so he was staggering in circles, firing his gun. It was a wonder he hadn't hit anyone yet. I took the gun away and hit him on the head with it. The smoke was densest near the doors, making it impossible to see out. It was just as impossible, of course, to see in, so no one in the street had any real idea of what had happened. They, of course, knew something was wrong. Two policemen had rushed in with guns drawn, but were now as helpless as the rest. I organized the relief of the sufferers then, and began pulling and guiding them to the door. When I had enough of a crowd collected, I joined them, and we all crawled out into the street together. I put the goggles in my pocket and kept my eyes closed until I had groped clear of the gas. Some worthy citizens helped me, and I thanked them, tears streaming down my face from the fringes of the gas, and went my way. That's how easy it is. That's how easy it always is if you plan ahead and don't take foolish risks. My morale was high, and the blood sang in my veins. Life was deliciously crooked and worth living again. Finding Angelina's trail now would be simplicity itself. There was nothing I couldn't do. Staying on the crest of this emotional wave, I rented a room in a spaceman's hotel near the port, cleaned up, and strode forth to enjoy the pleasures of life. There were many rough-and-ready joints in the area, and I made the rounds. I had a steak in one and a drink apiece in each of the others. If Angelina had come to Freiber, she would surely have passed, at least briefly, through this area. The trail would be here. I felt that in my bones. Crooked bones, once again, and sympathetic to her own lawlessness. "How's about buying a girl a drink?" the tart said spiritlessly, and I shook my head no with the same lack of interest. The hostesses, pallid creatures of the night, were coming out as the evening progressed. I was getting a good share of propositions, since I had taken care to look like a spaceman on leave. Always a good source of revenue for these women. This one was the latest of a number who had approached me, a little better looking than most, at least better constructed.
I watched her walking away with interest that bordered on admiration. Her skirt was short, tight, and slashed high up on the sides. High heels lent a rotating motion to this, producing a most effective result. She reached the bar and turned to survey the room, and I couldn't help but appreciate the rest of her. Her blouse was made of thin strips of shimmering fabric, joined together only at the tops and bottoms. They separated to reveal enticing slices of creamy skin whenever she moved, and I'm sure had the desired effect on masculine libidos. My eyes finally reached her face, a long trip since I had started the survey at her ankles, and she was quite attractive. Almost familiar. Exactly at this instant, my heart gave a grinding thud in my chest and I grew rigid in my chair. It seemed impossible, yet it had to be true. She was Angelina. Chapter 10. Her hair had been bleached, and there were some simple and obvious changes in her features. They had been altered just enough so it would be impossible to identify her from a photograph or a description. She could never be recognized. Except by me, that is. I had seen her in the stolen battleship, and I had talked to her. And the nice part was, I could identify her, and she would have no idea of who I was. She had seen me only briefly, in a spacesuit with a tinted faceplate, and I'm sure had plenty of other things to think about at the time. This was the climax of the most successful day of my life. The fetid air of the dive was like wine in my nostrils. I relaxed and savored every last drop of irony in the situation. You had to give the girl credit, though. She had adopted a perfect cover. I myself had never imagined she would stay here, and thought I had weighed all of the possibilities. Because she had taken a good bit of the stolen cash with her, I had never considered she would be living like a penniless tramp. The girl had guts. You had to give her credit. She had adopted an almost perfect disguise and blended neatly into the background. If only she wasn't so damned kill-happy, what a team we would make. My heart gave the second grinding thump of the evening when I realized the dead-end trail down which my emotions were leading me. Angelina was disaster to anyone she came near. Inside that lovely head squatted a highly intelligent but strangely warped brain. For my own sake, I would be better off thinking about the corpses she had piled up, not about her figure. There was only one thing to be done. Get her away from here and turn her over to the Corps. I didn't even consider how I felt about the Corps, or how they felt about me. This was an entirely different affair that had to be done neatly and with dispatch before I changed my mind. I joined her at the bar, and ordered two double shots of the local battery acid. Being careful, I deepened my voice and changed my accent and manner of speaking. Angelina had heard enough of my voice to identify it easily. That was the one thing I had to be aware of.
"Drink up, doll," I said, raising my drink and leering at her. "Then we go up to your place. You got a place, don't you?"
"I got a place. You got a League 10 spot in hard change?" "Of course," I grumbled, feigning insult.
"You think I'm buying this bilge juice on the arm?"
"I ain't no cafeteria pay on your way out," she said, with a bored lack of interest that was magnificent. "Pay now, and then we go." When I flipped the 10 credits her way, she speared it neatly out of the air, weighed it, bit it, and vanished it inside her belt. I looked on with frank admiration, which she would mistake for carnal interest, but was in reality appreciation of the faultless manner with which she played her role. Only when she turned away did I make myself remember that this was business, not pleasure, and I had a stern duty to perform. My resolution was wavering, and I screwed it tight again with a memory of corpses floating in space. Draining my glass, I followed her marvelous rotation out of the bar and down a noisome alley. The dark decrepitude of the narrow passage jarred my reflexes awake. Angelina played her part well, but I doubted if she bedded down with all the space tramps who hit this port. There was a good chance that she had a confederate around who had a strong right arm with a heavy object clutched tightly in his hand. Or perhaps I'm naturally suspicious. My hand was on the gun in my pocket, but I didn't need to use it. We threaded across another street and turned into a hallway. She went first, and we didn't talk. No one came near us or even bothered to notice us. When she unlocked her room, I relaxed a bit. It was small and tawdry, but offered no possible hiding place for an accomplice. Angelina went straight to the bed, and I checked the door to see if it really was locked. It was. When I turned around, she was pointing a .75-caliber recoilless automatic at me, so big and ugly that she had to hold it in both tiny hands. "What the hell is the racket?" I blustered, fighting back the sixth sensation that I had missed an important clue someplace along the line. My hand was still on the gun in my pocket, but trying to draw it would be instant suicide. "I'm going to kill you without ever even knowing your name," she said sweetly, with a cute smile that showed even white teeth. "But you have this coming for ruining my battleship operation." Still, she didn't fire, but her grin widened until it was almost a laugh. She was enjoying the uncontrolled expressions on my face as I recognized the fact that I had been outthought all the way along the line. That the trapper was the trapee, that she had me exactly precisely where she wanted me, and there wasn't a single bloody damn thing I could do about it. Angelina finally had to laugh out loud, a laugh clear and charming as a silver bell, as she watched me reach these sickening conclusions one after another. She was an artist to her fingertips and waited just long enough for me to understand everything. Then, at the exact and ultimate moment of my maximum realization and despair, she pulled the trigger. Not once, but over and over again. 4 tearing, thundering bullets of pain directly into my heart. And a final slug directly between my eyes. Chapter 11. It wasn't really consciousness, but a sort of ruddy, pain-filled blur. A gut-gripping nausea fought with the pain, but won easily. Part of the trouble was that my eyes were closed, yet opening them was incredibly difficult. I finally managed it and could make out a face swimming in a blur above me.
"What happened?" the blur asked.
"I was going to ask you the same thing," I said, and stopped, surprised at how weak and bubbly my voice was. Something brushed across my lips, and I saw a red-stained pad as it went away. After I blinked some sight back into my eyes, Blurface turned out to be a youngish man dressed in white. A doctor, I suppose, and I was aware of motion. We must be driving in an ambulance.
"Who shot you?" the doctor asked. "Someone reported the shots, and you'll be pleased to know we got there just in the old nick of time. You've lost a lot of blood, some of which I've replaced, have multiple fractures of the radius and ulna, an extensive bullet wound in your forearm, a further wound in your right temple, possible fracture of the skull, extremely probable fractures in your ribs, and the possibility of internal injuries. Someone got a grudge against you?"
"Who?"
"Who?
My darling Angelina, that's who. Temptress, sorceress, murderess. That's who tried to kill me. I remembered now. The wide black muzzle of the gun looking big enough to park a spaceship in. The fire blasting out of it, the slugs hammering into me. And the pain as my expensive, guaranteed bulletproof underwear soaked up the impact of the bullets, spreading it across the entire front of my body. I remembered the hope that this would satisfy her, and the despair of hope as the muzzle of that reeking gun lifted to my face. I remembered the last instant of regret as I put my arms before my face and threw myself sideways in a vain attempt at escape. The funny thing is, that escape attempt had worked. The bullet that had smashed my forearm must have been deflected enough by the bone to carom off my skull, instead of catching it point blank and drilling on through. All this had produced satisfactory quantities of blood and an immobile body on the floor. That had caused Angelina's mistake, her only one. The boom of the gun in that tiny room, my apparent corpse, the blood, it must have all rattled the female side of her at least a bit. She had to leave fast before the shots were investigated, and she had not taken that extra bit of time to make sure. "Lie down," the doctor said. "I'll give you an injection that will knock you out for a week if you don't lie down."
Only when he said this did I realize I was half sitting up in the stretcher and chuckling a particularly dirty laugh. I let myself be pushed down easily, since my chest was drenched in pain whenever I moved. Right at that moment, my mind began ticking over plans for making the most of the situation. Ignoring the pain as well as I could, I looked around the ambulance, looking for a way to capitalize on the bit of luck that had kept me still alive while she thought I was dead. We pulled up at the hospital then, and there was nothing much I could do in the ambulance except steal the stylus and official forms from the rack above my head. My right arm was still good, though it hurt like fire whenever I moved. A robot snapped the wheels down on my stretcher, latched onto it, and wheeled it inside. As it went by the doctor, he slipped some papers into a holder near my head and waved goodbye to me. I gave him back a gallant smile as I trundled into the butcher shop. As soon as he was out of sight, I pulled out the papers and scanned them quickly. Here lay my opportunity if I had enough time to grab it. There was the doctor's report in quadruplicate. Until these forms were fed into the machinery, I didn't exist. I was in a statistical limbo out of which I would be born into the hospital. Stillborn, if I had my way. I pushed my pillow off onto the corridor floor, and the robot stopped. He paid no attention to my writing and didn't seem to mind stopping two more times to rescue the pillow, giving me time to finish my forgery. This Dr. McVicblez, at least that's what his signature reads like, had a lot to learn about signing papers. He had left acres of clear space between the last line of the report and his signature. I filled this with a very passable imitation of his handwriting. Massive internal hemorrhage. Shock, I wrote. Died en route. This sounded official enough. I quickly added, all attempts resuscitation failed. I had a moment of doubt about spelling this jawbreaker, but since Dr. McVibgles thought there were two P's and multiple, he could be expected to muff this one, too. This last line made sure there wouldn't be any hanky-panky with needles and electric prods to jazz some life back into the corpse. We turned out of the corridor just as I slipped the forms back into their slot and lay back trying to look dead.
Here's a DOA, Sven, someone called out, rustling the papers behind my head.
I heard the robot rolling away, untroubled by the fact that his writing pillow-shedding patient was suddenly dead. This lack of curiosity is what I like about robots. I tried to think dead thoughts and hoped the right expression was showing on my face. Something jerked at my left foot, and my boot and sock were pulled off. A hand grabbed my foot.
How tragic, the sympathetic soul said. He's still warm. Maybe we should put him on the table and get the revival team down.
What a nosy, mealy-mouthed, interfering sod he was.
Nah, the voice of a wiser and cooler head said from across the room. They tried the works in the ambulance. Slide him in the box.
A terrifying pain lanced through my foot, and I almost gave the whole show away. Only the fiercest control enabled me to lie unmoving while this clown grimly tightened the wire around my big toe. There was a tag hanging from the wire, and I heartily wished the same tag was hung from his ear, secured by the same throttling wire. Pain from the toe washed up and joined the ache in my chest, head, and arm, and I fought for corpse-like rigidity as the stretcher trundled along. Somewhere behind me a heavy door opened, and a wave of frigid air struck my skin. I allowed myself a quick look through my lashes. If the corpses in this chop shop were stashed into individual freezers, I was about to be suddenly restored to life. I could think of a lot more pleasant ways of dying than in an icebox with the door handle on the outside. Lady Luck was still galloping along at my shoulder because my toe amputator was dragging me, stretcher and all, into a good-sized room. There were slabs on all sides, and a number of dearly departed had already arrived before me. With no attempt at gentleness, I was slid onto a freezing surface. Footsteps went away from me across the room, the door closed heavily, and the lights went out. My morale hit bottom at this moment. I had been through a lot for one day and was thoroughly battered, bruised, contused, and concussed. Being locked in a black room full of corpses had an unusually depressing effect on me. In spite of the pain in my chest and the tag trailing from my toe, I managed to slide off the slab and hobble to the door. Panic grew as I lost my direction, easing off only when I walked square into the wall. My fingers found a switch and the lights came back on, and of course my moral fiber stiffened at the same moment. The door was perfectly designed. I couldn't have done better myself, with no window and a handle on the inside. There was even a bolt so that it could be locked from this side, though for what hideous reason I couldn't possibly imagine. It gave me some needed privacy, though, so I slipped it into place. Although the room was full, no one was paying any attention to me. The first thing I did was unwind the wire and massage some life back into my numb toe. On the yellow tag were the large black letters DOA and a handwritten number, the same one that had been on the form I had altered. This was too good an opportunity to miss. I took the tag off the toe of the most badly battered nail corpse and substituted mine. His tag I pocketed, then spent a merry few minutes changing around all the other tags. During this process, I took a right shoe from the corpse with the biggest feet and jammed my frozen left foot into it. All the tags were hung from the left big toe, and I loudly cursed such needless precision. My chest was bare where my ship suit and bulletproof cover had been cut away. One of my silent friends had a warm shirt he didn't need, so I borrowed that too. Don't think for a second that all this was easy. I was staggering and mumbling to myself while I did it. When it was finished, I slapped off the light and cracked the door of the freezer. The air from the hall felt like a furnace. There wasn't a soul in sight, so I closed the vault and staggered over to the nearest door. It was to a storeroom, and the only thing there that I could use was a chair. I sat in this as long as I dared, then went looking again. The next door was locked, but the third one opened to a dark room where I could hear someone breathing evenly in his sleep. This was more like it. Whoever this sack-time artist was, he surely knew his sleeping trade. I rifled the room and fumbled with the clothes I found, and put them on clumsily, yet he never heard a sound. Which was probably the best thing for him, because I was in a skull-fracturing humor. The novelty of this little affair had worn off, and all I could think about was the pain. There was a hat, too, so I put this on and checked out. I saw people at a distance, but no one was watching when I pushed open an emergency exit and found myself back on the rain-drenched streets of Freiberbad. Chapter 12. That night and the next few days are hazy in the memory for obvious reasons. It was a risk to go back to my room, but a calculated one. The chances were good that Angelina didn't know of its existence, or even if she had found out, that she wouldn't have done anything about it. I was dead, and she had no further interest in me. This appeared to be true, because I wasn't bothered after I was in the room. I had the management send up some food, and at least 2 bottles of liquor a day, so it would look like I was on an extended and solitary bender. The rot gut went down the drain, and I picked a bit at the food while my body slowly recovered. I kept my aching flesh drenched in antibiotics and loaded with painkillers, and counted myself lucky. On the third morning, I felt weak, but almost human. My arm in the cast throbbed when I moved it. The black and blue marks on my chest were turning gorgeous shades of violet and gold. But my headache was almost gone. It was time to plan for the future. I sipped some of the liquor I had been using to flush out the plumbing, and called down for the newspapers of the past 3 days. The ancient delivery tube wheezed and disgorged them onto the table. Going through them carefully, I was pleased to discover that my plan had worked much better than should have been expected. The day after my murder, there had been items in every paper about it, grubbed from the hospital records by the slothful news hounds who hadn't even bothered to glance at the corpse. That was all. Nothing later about big hospital scandal and missing corpse, or suit brought because that's not Uncle Frim in the coffin. If my jiggery-pokery in the frozen meat locker had been uncovered, it was being kept a hospital family secret, and heads were rolling in private. Angelina, my sharpshooting sweetheart, must then think of me as securely dead, a victim of her own murderous trigger finger. Nothing could be better. As soon as I was able to, I would be getting back on her trail again. The job of tracking her made immensely simpler by her believing me to be a wisp of greasy smoke in the local crematorium. There was plenty of time now to plan this thing, and plan it right. No more funny business about who was hunting whom. I was going to get as much pleasure out of arresting Angelina as she had derived from blasting away at me with her portable artillery. It was a humiliating but true fact that she had outmaneuvered me all the way down the line. She had stolen the battleship from under my nose, torn a wide swath through galactic shipping, then escaped neatly right under my gun. What made the situation most embarrassing was that she had set a trap for me when I thought I was hunting her. Hindsight is a great revealer of obviosities, and this one was painfully clear now. While escaping from the captured battleship, she had not been hysterical in the slightest. That role had been feigned. She had been studying me, every bit of my face that could be seen, every intonation of my voice. Hatred had seared my picture in her memory, and while escaping, she must have considered constantly how I would be thinking when I followed her. At the safest and least obvious spot in her flight, she had stopped and waited. Knowing I would come, and knowing that she would be more prepared for the encounter than I was. This was all past history. Now it was my turn to deal the cards. All kinds of schemes and plans trotted through my head to be weighed and sampled. Top priority, before anything else was attempted, would be a complete physical change for me. This would be necessary if I wanted to catch up with Angelina. It was also required if I were to stay out of the long reach of the Corps. The fact had not been mentioned during my training, but I was fairly sure the only way one left the Special Corps was feet first. Though I was physically down and out, there was nothing wrong with the old think box, and I put it to use. Facts were needed, and I gave a small endowment to the city library in the form of rental fees. Fortunately, there were film copies of all the local newspapers available, going back for years. I made the acquaintance of an extremely yellowish journal endearingly called Hot News. Hot News aimed at a popular readership with a vocabulary I estimated at approximately 300 words, who relished violence in its multiform aspects. Most of the time, these were just copter accidents and such, with full-color photos, of course. But very often there were juicy muggings, sluggings, and such, which proved the quieting hand of galactic civilization still hadn't throttled Freiber completely. In among these exaggerated tales of violence lay the murky crime I was searching for. Mankind has always been capricious in its lawmaking, inventing such intriguingly different terms as manslaughter, justified homicide, and such, as if dead wasn't dead. Though fashions in both crime and sentencing come and go, there is one crime that will always bring universal detestation. That is the crime of being a bungling doctor. I have heard tell that certain savage tribes used to slaughter the physician if his patient died, a system that is not without merit. This single-minded loathing of the butchering quack is understandable. When ill, we deliver ourselves completely into the doctor's hands. We give a complete stranger the opportunity to toy with that which we value most. If this trust is violated, there is naturally a hotness of temper among the witnesses or survivors. Ordinary citizen Wolf Sifternitz had formerly been the highly esteemed Dr. Sifternitz. Hot News explained in overly lavish detail how he had mixed the life of playboy and surgeon until finally the knife in his twitching fingers had cut that instead of this, and the life of a prominent politician had been shortened by a number of no doubt profitable years. We must give Wolf credit for the fact that he had made an attempt to sober up before going to work, so that it was DTs, not drunkenness, that caused the fatal twitch. His license was removed, and he must have been fined most of his savings, since there were later references to his having been involved in more sordid medical affairs. Life had treated Wolf hard and dirty. He was just the man I was looking for. On my first rubber-legged trip out of my room, I took the liberty of paying him a professional call. To a person of my abilities, tracking down a pseudo-legal stranger in a foreign city, a far planet presents no problems. Just a matter of technique, and I am rich in technique. When I hammered on the stained wooden door in the least wholesome section of town, I was ready to take the first step in my new plan. "I have some business for you, Wolf," I told the bleary-eyed Stewie, who opened the door. "Get the hell lost," he said, and tried to close the door in my face. My carefully placed shoe prevented this, and it took almost no effort at all to push in past him. "I don't do any medical work," he mumbled, looking at my bandaged arm. "Not for police stoolies, I don't. So get the hell lost." "Your conversation is both dull and repetitious," I told him, because it was. "I am here to offer you a strictly legitimate business deal with value given for money received. The mere fact that it happens to be illegal should bother neither of us, least of all you." I ignored his mumbled protests and looked into the next room. "According to information of great reliability, you live here in unmarried bliss with a girl named Xena. What I have to say is not for her undoubtedly shell-like ears. Where is she?" "Out," he shouted, "and you too, out!" He clutched a tall bottle by the neck and raised it threateningly. "Would you like that?" I asked, and dropped a thick wad of fresh banknotes on the table. "And that? And that?" I followed with two more bundles. The bottle slipped from his loose fingers and fell to the floor, while his eyes bulged out further and further as if they were on pistons. I added a few more bundles to the pile until I had his undivided attention. It really didn't take much discussion. Once he had assured himself that I really meant to go through with the proposition, it was just a matter of settling the details. The money had an instantly sobering effect on him, and though he had a tendency to twitch and vibrate, there was nothing wrong with his reasoning powers. "Just one last problem," I said as I started to leave. "What about the worthy Xena? Are you going to tell her about this?"
"You crazy?"
Wolf asked with undisguised surprise. "I suppose that means you won't tell her. Since only you and I are going to know about this operation, how are you going to explain your absence or where the money has come from?" This was even more shocking to him.
"Explain? To her? She isn't going to see either me or the money once I leave here, which will be no more than 10 minutes from now."
"I see," I said. And I did. I also thought it was rather uncharitable of him, since the unlucky Xena had been supporting him by practicing a trade that most women shun. I made a mental note to see what could be done to even the score a little. In the future, though. Right now I had to see to the dissolution of James Bolivar de Grizz. Sparing no expense, I ordered all the surgical and operating room equipment that Wolf could suggest. Whenever possible, I bought robot control devices, since he would be working alone. Everything was loaded in a heavy carrier, rented for the occasion, and we drove out to the house in the country together. Neither of us would trust the other out of his sight, which was, of course, understandable. Financial payments were the hardest to arrange, since the pure-hearted Dr. Wolf was sure I would bash in his skull and take back all of my money once the job was finished, never realizing, of course, that as long as there were banks, I would never be broke. The safeguards were finally arranged to his satisfaction, and we began our solitary and important business. The house was lonely and self-contained, perched on the cliff above a far reach of the lake. What fresh food we needed was delivered once a week, along with the mail, which consisted of drugs and other medical supplies. The operations began. Modern surgical techniques being what they are, there was of course no pain or shock. I was confined to bed and at times was loaded with so much sedation that days passed in a dreamy fog. Between two periods of radical surgery, I took the precaution of seeing that a sleeping pill was included in Wolf's evening drink. This drink was, of course, non-alcoholic, since his traveling this entire course mounted on the water wagon was one of the conditions of our agreement. Whenever he found it difficult, I restored his resolution with a little more money. All this continence had his nerves on edge, and I thought he would appreciate a good night's sleep. I also wanted to do a little investigating. When I was sure he was deeply under, I picked the lock of his door and searched his room. I suppose the gun was there.